A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about something he remembers from studying law in Ireland. This whole historical split between common law courts and equity courts, and whether that bifurcation shows up in legal systems with different ancestry. Specifically, does Israel's legal system have any parallel to this division between the strict letter of the law and some later recognized need for common sense and reasonableness? Or was the whole equity versus law thing purely a Commonwealth product?
This is exactly the kind of question that gets more interesting the deeper you dig. Because the short answer is no, the formal equity versus common law split is uniquely English, but the problem it solved is completely universal. Every legal system that's ever existed has had to figure out what happens when following the rules produces an unjust result.
The law's version of congratulations, you played yourself.
An English solution was genuinely weird. They didn't just say judges should be reasonable, they built an entire parallel court system with its own personnel, its own procedures, its own remedies, and its own body of precedent. For about 500 years, if you wanted an injunction rather than money damages, you literally walked into a different building and asked a different official.
Which sounds like the legal equivalent of having two competing operating systems running on the same machine and hoping they don't crash.
They did crash. That's the Earl of Oxford's case in 1605, which is one of the great showdowns in legal history. You had Sir Edward Coke, the Chief Justice of the King's Bench, the Common Law Supremo, facing off against Lord Ellesmere, the Lord Chancellor, who ran the Court of Chancery. The specific dispute was over a land conveyance, but the real fight was about who had ultimate authority. Coke said the common law courts were supreme. Ellesmere said equity could override common law judgments when they were obtained by oppression or fraud. James I had to step in and decide, and he sided with equity.
A king resolving a turf war between judges. Nothing could possibly go wrong with that institutional design.
Yet the principle stuck. When the Judicature Acts of 1873 to 1875 finally fused the courts of law and equity into a single system, Section 25, Subsection 11, of the 1873 Act explicitly provided that in any conflict between common law and equitable rules, equity shall prevail. That's still the law in England and in most common law jurisdictions that followed the English model.
Equity won the 500-year war, but lost its own building.
Right, and that's the key thing. The fusion was procedural, not substantive. You no longer have to choose between filing in Chancery or filing in King's Bench, but equitable doctrines like estoppel, fiduciary duties, undue influence, unclean hands. Those all still exist as distinct bodies of law. They didn't get absorbed into the common law. They just share a courtroom now.
Which brings us to why this split happened in the first place. What was so rigid about the common law that it needed a whole parallel system to fix it?
The writ system. If you were bringing a case in the common law courts in the 13th century, you had to fit your grievance into one of the existing writs, the standardized forms of action. If your situation didn't match an available writ, you had no remedy, and the common law courts were obsessive about procedural technicalities. One mistake in your pleading and your case was thrown out, no matter how meritorious. The system valued certainty over justice, and eventually that became unbearable. People started petitioning the king directly for relief.
The original, let me speak to the manager.
The king delegated those petitions to his chancellor, who was usually a bishop, the keeper of the king's conscience. The chancellor wasn't bound by the writ system or by precedent in the same way. He could look at the whole situation and decide what was fair. Over time, this ad hoc petition process formalized into the Court of Chancery, with its own doctrines and its own maxims.
The maxims are important, because there's a misconception here that equity just meant judges doing whatever feels right.
Equity developed its own strict rules. He who comes to equity must come with clean hands. Equity follows the law. Delay defeats equity. Equity acts in personam, meaning it operates on the person, not the property. These are vague vibes. They're constraints. The Chancellor couldn't just decide he liked one party better. He had to work within a framework that was different from the common law's framework, but no less rigorous.
The English story is, common law gets rigid, people petition the king, the Chancellor develops a parallel system of conscience-based justice, that system develops its own rules, the two systems clash, and then they fuse procedurally in the 19th century while remaining doctrinally distinct. Ireland followed the same path.
Ireland established its own court of chancery in the 13th century, and the Judicature Ireland Act of 1877 mirrored the English fusion. But Ireland's experience had a distinct flavor because equity intersected with land law and the penal laws in ways that were uniquely fraught. If you were a Catholic tenant farmer in 18th century Ireland, the question of whether you could get equitable relief from a Protestant landlord's common law rights was not an academic one.
It never is. That's what makes this whole area of law compelling. It's not just doctrinal taxonomy. It's about who gets thrown out of their home and who doesn't.
Which is exactly why the question about Israel is so interesting. Israel inherited English common law and equity through the British Mandate, but it also inherited Ottoman law, and it's developed its own legislation and jurisprudence over the past 70-plus years. So what happened to equity in that mix?
Let's get into it. What does Israel's legal system actually look like as a historical patchwork?
It's a palimpsest, which is the perfect word for it, a manuscript that's been scraped and written over multiple times. You've got Ottoman law, primarily the Mesel, which was the Ottoman civil code based on Hanafi Islamic jurisprudence. That governed land law, contracts, and civil obligations in Palestine from the 1870s through the end of the Ottoman period. Then the British Mandate arrives in 1917, and they start layering in English common law equity and statute law. The King's Order in Council of 1922 explicitly provided that the law of England, including equity, would apply in Palestine, subject to local circumstances.
For about 30 years, you had English equity operating in what would become Israel as a formal matter.
And then 1948 happens. Israel is established, and gradually the Knesset starts passing its own legislation. The big formal break came with the Foundations of Law Act in 1980. Section 2 of that act says that when a court faces a legal question that can't be answered by statute, precedent, or analogy, it shall decide in the light of the principles of freedom, justice, equity, and peace of the Jewish heritage.
Wait, equity is actually named in the statute?
The word appears right there, but it's not English equity. It's equity as part of a quartet of values drawn from Jewish heritage, freedom, justice, equity, peace. The Hebrew word is yosher, which has its own rich connotations in Jewish legal thought. And the 1980 Act formally severed the binding link to English law. So from that point forward, Israeli courts are no longer required to follow English precedents, though they can still find them persuasive.
Israel had English equity, then formally cut the cord, but kept the word equity in its foundational statute while reinterpreting it through a Jewish legal lens.
That's just the formal story. In practice, Israeli courts still use equitable remedies, injunctions, specific performance, declaratory relief, and equitable doctrines like estoppel, unclean hands, and lackeys are alive and well. But there's no separate equity jurisdiction. It's all fused. And Israeli law has developed its own general principles that do the work equity used to do. Good faith is the big one. The Israeli Contracts Law of 1973, sections 12 and 39, impose a duty of good faith in negotiating and performing contracts, and the courts have interpreted this broadly. Section 39 says that an obligation must be performed in good faith, and a right must be exercised in good faith. That's not a suggestion. It's a mandatory duty that courts can use to modify contractual outcomes.
Which sounds a lot like what the German Civil Code does with its good faith clause.
Section 242 of the German BGB, enacted in 1900, requires performance in good faith having regard to common usage. And that one clause has generated thousands of court decisions creating what is effectively a de facto equity jurisprudence. German judges use it to modify contracts, to fill gaps, to prevent abuse of rights. They don't call it equity, but functionally, that's what it is.
The civil law tradition gets to the same destination, tempering strict legal rules with fairness, but through general clauses in codes rather than through a separate court system.
That's the central insight here. The common law's equity versus law split is a specific historical solution to a universal problem. Every legal system has to figure out how to balance certainty and flexibility, rules and justice. The English did it by building a parallel system. The Germans did it by writing good faith into their civil code and letting judges run with it. The Israelis did it by layering Jewish legal concepts onto an English foundation and then developing robust judicial review.
The Israeli Supreme Court has been particularly aggressive in developing what amounts to an equity jurisdiction, especially in administrative and constitutional law.
This is where it gets really interesting. Israel doesn't have a formal constitution. It has basic laws that the Supreme Court has treated as constitutional in character. And without a written constitution to constrain it, the court has developed an extraordinarily robust doctrine of proportionality and reasonableness review. The key case is Beitzort Village Council versus Israel from 2004.
The separation barrier case.
The court applied a four-part proportionality test to determine whether the root of the barrier was lawful. Proper purpose, rational connection, necessity, and proportionality stricto sensu, meaning the benefit must outweigh the harm. That test didn't come from English equity. It came from German constitutional law, imported by Justice Aharon Barak, who was the dominant figure on the Israeli Supreme Court for decades.
You've got an Israeli court using a German test to review government action in a legal system built on Ottoman and British foundations, and the result is something that functions like equity, but isn't called equity.
The reasonableness doctrine goes even further. Israeli courts can strike down administrative decisions that are extremely unreasonable. Not just illegal, not just procedurally improper, but substantively unreasonable. That's a level of judicial oversight that would be unthinkable in many common law systems, including the English system that Israel inherited.
Which is ironic, because England basically invented the idea of judges checking administrative power.
English judges are much more deferential than Israeli judges. The Wensbury unreasonableness standard in English law requires a decision to be so unreasonable that no reasonable authority could have made it. The Israeli standard is more searching, and the current government has been trying to rein it in. The reasonableness standard was actually a major flashpoint in the judicial reform controversy of 2023.
The equity impulse. The desire to have some mechanism for correcting harsh or unreasonable outcomes keeps surfacing even when you try to suppress it.
Because it's a functional necessity. Let me give you a few more comparative examples to show how universal this is. In Islamic law, the Hanafi school developed a doctrine called istishan, juristic preference, where a judge can depart from a strict analogy, aqiyas, in favor of a more equitable outcome based on public interest. The Maliki school has istisla, which is reasoning based on the public welfare. And there's the broader concept of siyasa sharia, sharia-oriented policy, that allows rulers and judges to make decisions based on justice and public interest even when they deviate from strict doctrinal rules.
Islamic jurisprudence built equity-like escape valves directly into the system.
In Hindu legal tradition, the concept of dharma functioned as a meta-legal principle that could override strict rules. A judge wasn't just applying the letter of the law, they were supposed to be realizing dharma, which encompasses justice, righteousness, and cosmic order. That's a much more expansive mandate than an English common law judge ever had.
The English chancellor had the king's conscience. The Hindu judge had the cosmic order. Different job descriptions.
In Chinese legal tradition, there's been a long-standing emphasis on mediation and substantive justice over procedural formality. The ideal was never a perfectly applied rule. It was a harmonious resolution. So the tension between rules and equity shows up differently, but it's still the same underlying dynamic.
Which brings us back to the core question. Is the common law's equity split just a historical accident? A weird thing that happened because medieval English writs were too rigid? Or is it a structural necessity that every system has to address one way or another?
I think the evidence points strongly to structural necessity. The specific form it took in England, separate courts, the Lord Chancellor, the whole drama with Coke and Ellesmere, that's contingent history. If the common law courts had been slightly more flexible in the 13th century, maybe equity never splits off. But the underlying problem is inescapable. Rules are general, life is particular. Sooner or later, a rule that makes perfect sense in the abstract will produce a result that shocks the conscience in a specific case.
The edge case problem.
And every legal system has to decide what to do about edge cases. You can ignore them and accept the injustice in the name of certainty. You can create a parallel system to handle them. You can give judges broad discretion through general clauses. You can rely on legislative override. But you can't make the edge cases go away.
What does Israel's experience specifically teach us about whether you can have a fuse system that still delivers equitable outcomes?
Israel shows that a fuse system can work without a formal equity doctrine, but only if judges have the tools, proportionality, good faith, reasonableness, to reach equitable results, and only if there's institutional trust in the judiciary. When that trust erodes, the whole arrangement becomes politically contested, which is exactly what we've seen in recent years.
Because if equity ultimately depends on judges having discretion, and people stop trusting judges, the system starts to look illegitimate.
That's the paradox at the heart of equity. It exists because strict rules sometimes produce injustice, but discretion itself can be arbitrary. The solution is to constrain discretion with doctrines and maxims, but those constraints can become rigid, recreating the original problem. It's a cycle.
The equity Ouroboros, eating its own clean hands.
Here's where the AI angle becomes relevant. If we're moving toward algorithmic adjudication, AI systems making or recommending legal decisions about sentencing, bail, contract disputes, were essentially recreating the conditions that made equity necessary in the first place. An algorithm applies rules. It doesn't have a conscience. It can't look at a specific case and say, this outcome is technically correct but manifestly unjust.
Unless you build in an override mechanism.
What does that mechanism look like? A human review layer? A separate equity algorithm that checks the first algorithm's outputs? We'd be reinventing the court of chancery just in software.
He who comes to equity must come with clean data.
You're joking, but that's actually a real problem. Algorithmic bias is the modern equivalent of a corrupt chancellor. If your AI is trained on biased data, its equitable overrides might just encode and amplify existing injustices.
The lesson from 500 years of equity jurisprudence is that the escape valve itself needs constraints, and the constraints need to be transparent, and someone needs to be accountable when the whole thing goes wrong.
That's the conversation we're barely starting to have about AI and law. We're so focused on whether algorithms can apply rules efficiently that we're not thinking enough about what happens when the rules produce the wrong answer, and the algorithm has no way to know.
Let me pull on one more thread. You mentioned that Israel's Foundations of Law Act directs courts to look to the principles of freedom, justice, equity, and peace of the Jewish heritage. What does equity actually mean in that context? Is it just a translation of yosher? And what's the Jewish legal concept behind it?
Yosher is fascinating. In Jewish legal thought, it's the idea of going beyond the strict letter of the law, lifnim mishurat hadin, acting within the line of the law but beyond its minimum requirements. The Talmud talks about this in the context of moral obligation that isn't legally enforceable. But over time, some of these moral obligations got juridified. They became legal duties. The Israeli Supreme Court, particularly under Aharon Barak, was explicit about drawing on Jewish legal concepts of justice and equity to inform its jurisprudence.
It's not just a translation of English equity. It's a distinct concept with its own intellectual history.
Right. And that's what makes Israel such a rich case study. You've got English equity as a formal inheritance from the Mandate period. You've got the German-influenced proportionality framework that Barak imported. You've got Jewish legal concepts of yosher and lifnim mishurat hadin. And you've got Ottoman legal residues. All of these are swirling around in the same system, and Israeli judges draw on them eclectically.
The legal equivalent of fusion cuisine.
It produces some novel solutions. Take the doctrine of good faith in Israeli contract law. It's codified in the 1973 contracts law, so it's statutory, not equitable in the English sense. But the courts have interpreted it so expansively that it does work that in England would be done by estoppel or fiduciary duty or undue influence, all equitable doctrines. All equitable doctrines. The label is civil law, but the function is equity.
Which suggests that the label might not matter very much. What matters is whether the system has some way to say, this result is technically correct, but we're not going to do it because it's wrong.
That's the universal test. If a legal system has no mechanism for that, if it always privileges the rule over the result, it's going to produce injustices that eventually delegitimize the whole enterprise. People won't accept a system that's perfectly consistent and perfectly cruel.
The common law solution was to build a separate court. The civil law solution was general clauses. The Israeli solution was robust judicial review drawing on multiple traditions. The Islamic solution was juristic preference and public interest. The Hindu solution was dharma as a legal override.
Different architectures, same problem. And I think that's the most useful way to answer the original question. The formal equity versus law split is a Commonwealth product. It's a specific historical artifact of English legal development. But the function that equity serves is universal, and you can find functional equivalents in every mature legal system.
Including Israel's, which is especially interesting because it had English equity, then formally abandoned it, and then rebuilt the same functionality using different materials.
The Foundations of Law Act of 1980 is the hinge point. Before 1980, Israeli courts were bound by English precedents, including equity. After 1980, they were free to develop their own approach. And what they developed was a synthesis. Common law remedies and doctrines, civil law general clauses, Jewish legal concepts, and German proportionality analysis. It's not equity in the English sense, but it's equity in the functional sense.
That synthesis is still evolving. The judicial reform debate of the last few years is fundamentally about how much equitable discretion Israeli judges should have,
which is the same debate England had in 1605 between Coke and Ellesmere. The same debate every legal system has when judges start overriding elected officials in the name of justice or reasonableness or proportionality. Who guards the guardians? Who checks the chancellor's conscience?
The answer in 1615 was the king. The answer in a modern democracy is supposed to be the constitution, or the legislature, or public opinion. But Israel doesn't have a formal constitution, so the question is permanently unsettled.
That permanent unsettlement might actually be a feature, not a bug. Equity is inherently dynamic. It exists to correct the law when the law produces unjust results. But what counts as unjust changes over time? A system that locks in a single answer to the equity question is a system that's going to fossilize.
Israel's unresolved tension between judicial discretion and legislative supremacy is uncomfortable, but it might be healthier than a system that thinks it solved the problem once and for all.
I think that's right. The common law's great insight was that you can't eliminate the tension between rules and justice. You can only manage it through institutional design, and different systems manage it differently. The key is to have some mechanism and to have it be transparent and accountable.
Which brings us to the forward-looking part of this. If equity is a functional necessity, and we're now building AI systems that make or recommend legal decisions, where's the equity in that?
That's the question that keeps me up at night. Current AI systems are trained on past decisions. They learn patterns. They can apply rules consistently, more consistently than humans, probably. But they can't recognize when a consistent application of the rule produces an unjust result, because they don't understand justice. They understand pattern matching.
We'd be recreating the common law courts of the 13th century. Rigid, procedurally obsessed, unable to see when the system is failing a specific person.
The solution can't just be add a human override, because then you've just recreated equity as a separate system, and you have to figure out who the human is, what standards they're applying, and how to hold them accountable.
The Lord Chancellor, version 2.0.
Maybe the lesson from legal history is that we should build the equity into the system from the start, rather than bolting it on later. If we're designing AI adjudication systems, we should be thinking about how to encode equitable principles, clean hands, proportionality, good faith, into the architecture, not just hoping a human catches the errors.
Which is a hard problem. How do you teach an algorithm about clean hands?
You probably can't, which is why the hybrid approach, algorithmic efficiency plus human judgment for edge cases, is likely where we'll land. But that requires us to be honest about what the algorithm can and can't do, and to design the human review layer with real teeth.
The Judicature Acts fused law and equity procedurally, but kept them doctrinally distinct. Maybe the AI equivalent is fusing algorithmic and human decision-making procedurally, but keeping the equitable override doctrinally distinct and explicitly labeled.
This decision was modified on equitable grounds. Transparency about when and why the override was used. That would be a start.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early Renaissance, European scholars widely attributed the elaborate coronation ceremony of the Mali Empire to the mythical Christian king Prester John, a misattribution that persisted for nearly a century before Portuguese explorers corrected the record, noting that Mansa Musa's court had developed its own entirely distinct ritual involving the royal griot reciting the emperor's lineage for 3 continuous hours before the crown could be placed on his head.
3 hours of lineage recitation. Sounds like my kind of ceremony.
I'd need a snack break.
Here's where I think we land. The common law's equity split was a specific historical product, but the need it addressed is universal. Every legal system develops some mechanism for tempering rules with justice. Israel's experience shows that you can build that mechanism out of mixed materials. English remedies, German proportionality, Jewish legal concepts, and it can work, but it'll always be contested.
The AI era is going to force us to have this conversation all over again. When we delegate legal decisions to machines, we're going to rediscover exactly why the medieval English felt they needed a court of chancery. The question is whether we'll learn from history or just repeat it.
If we repeat it, I'm calling dibs on being the Lord Chancellor.
You'd fall asleep during the lineage recitation.
That's just good pacing. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtoff for keeping us on track, and to everyone listening. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Find us at My Weird Prompts.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.